Well, folks, once again, it's my great pleasure to be here in the studio with Dan Renshaw as we continue the series of discussions about the history involving the area above Independence Mine, as well as the mine itself. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
We've been talking over the first two of the series about some individuals, and one of the things that I found kind of fascinating was how people got to the mine. And I know you've mentioned the railroad in the past. Is that a place we'd like to begin?
Well, the railroad is kind of in the middle of things, in as much as we had touched on the population boom and crash between the 1910 and the 1920 census, so it doesn't show up in those census. And the reason for that was the railroad, in part, also mineral development. The crash came because of World War One. So in the middle of all of this chaos, the railroad was struggling to get itself built. It ended up costing about twice the original cost estimate to get the railroad built. Because, in part, they had so much problem with labor. It was extremely involved with, and 1917, you got the Bolshevik Revolution. First you have the Tsar abdicates, then you have an interim government, then you have the Bolsheviks overthrowing the interim government, then you got civil war. Well, all of this is the communists are coming to the fore. And this is noted everywhere. President Wilson was just horrified with the specter of what communism could do. And he was terrified by it after he came back from Europe from the treaty.
Right.
It had its application in Alaska in as much as there was a group in Seattle, workers of the world, called the Wobblies. They were everywhere, but the Seattle group was especially active, mm-hmm. and they called themselves socialists. They were communists. They got really involved in the railroad work up here, so it was chaotic. They finally had to call in some military to try to quiet. There was a series of things like this. So the railroad starts in 1915, but it doesn't really get finished until 1923, the Alaska Railroad. At that time, really, the better name for it is the Alaska Engineering Commission Railroad, because it was later specifically named in legislation the Alaska Railroad with a capital T on the V. But that was 1923. They built it, and the idea was, okay, here they come. Nobody came. It was embarrassing to the government because they could only afford to run one train a week from Seward to Fairbanks. I mean, they spent this enormous amount of money in this wonderful application of engineering called the railroad.
But what you're saying is that by 1923, it was possible to go by train from Seward to Fairbanks.
Yes, 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 indeed. Enough on that. There's so many rabbit trails to follow on that particular issue. Where I'm wanting to go is the fact that they could not figure out why Alaska was in such doldrums. This is the Roaring Twenties. Everything is booming in the United States. Remember, we're a territory. The people that had left because of the war, most of them never came back. They were in the military. They got inoculated into other things. They had wonderful job opportunities in the United States. They also, there was a lot of them took out homesteads and other attachments to Alaska, but it just wasn't adequate. And the cost of doing business in gold mining, there was a lot of inflation after World War One, and gold mining was not profitable. So anyway, the end of it all was that the they finally decided, they being the Interior Department, that what they needed to do was to take this military operation called the Alaska Road Commission, and append it to, make it part of the Alaska Railroad, and give it the direction of creating better and improved resource roads, anything leading to the railroad that might encourage the railroad's activity.
Okay.
So in the Hatcher Pass area, the Willow Creek Mining District, this took the form of some real good improvements to the road in the late 20s. Before that time, the roads were, best word would be atrocious. They were really bad. No grading done to speak of. So hill and gully, up and down, around the corners, and a lot of mud, a lot of problems. There was a gentleman that had horses for doing freighting down at Fishhook. Now, there was a community at Fishhook, which there's nothing there now except the remnants of one homestead. But at during the 20s, there was a considerable community there. There was quite a bit of activity, but not like there would be later. The whole idea for the reason for Fishhook was when you freighted in from Connect with a wagon, four horses pulling a wagon. You had a full load, and that was a fairly level grade all the way to Fishhook. And then there were warehouses there where you could offload half or more of your load so you can continue on the steep grade going up to the mines. That and other things created this need for a community, and there was a roadhouse there too. Those roads, there to point out how bad the roads were, there was, after World War One, there was quite a bit of development on trucks that were replacing horses and wagons. But they were useless in the from Fishhook on up. The grades were too extreme. The roads were too bad. The guy by the name of Landers, who had the freighting business, he was an excellent person with horses. Another man we need to talk about.
Okay.
But Landers, for example, he was famous for being somebody who had taught his horses how to walk on snowshoes. This was quite an art, and he was successful.
Having just recently reacquainted myself with walking on snowshoes, that is difficult enough with two legs. But
yeah, no, he could do this. And so he could freight summer or winter. So from the warehouses, a lot of, even in the late 20s up into the early 30s, why, he was busy doing the freighting with horses. But when the Road Commission came in and started improving the roads, all of that changed. And another big change, Mike, was most of the mines in the Willow Creek District were seasonal. They had to run on water power. They might possibly manage 100 days, but that was exceptional.
Okay.
But when the water was done for the year, and they'd go to extreme measures to keep the water running, had ditches that were covered so that the snow wouldn't complicate slush and so on. But still, it was a difficult thing to keep a mill running. When the water gave out, the mining was done. They might do a little development work underground, but for the most part, they left.
Okay.
Most of the mining camps were tent camps, very poor. They were not insulated, not ready for the winter, no intention of staying around. This all changed with the improved roads. Better equipment became available on the market. Compressors and so on that were diesel operated. And suddenly it became possible, and the mines all started converting into a year-round operation because now they could haul diesel uphill and fill a tank and be able to put a diesel engine in that would allow them to continue running through the winter. This was a big deal for the gold cord mine. There was quite a division in the group over that.
In what way, when you say division?
Well, we talked recently about William and Pearl Horning.
Right.
Now, William was the older by 6 years, I believe. And he liked this seasonal thing of leaving. He wanted to go to Seattle or Point South. He didn't want to stay around. But there was a little meeting of the group, and Pearl, she was in control, and by gosh, Pearl wanted to do this because Pearl had a daughter who was at the, Pearl was living vicariously through her daughter. Her daughter, Jean, was treated to everything you can imagine. Went to the Sorbonne for college.
Oh, okay.
She decided she wanted to be a mining engineer, so she became the second woman graduate of the McKay School of Mines in Reno.
That is significant.
It's significant, yeah. I've got a picture of Jean and another lady who graduated at the same time, and they had to flip a coin to see who would be the first lady graduate.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So anyway, Jean, there are a lot of money going out to keep Jean fully occupied in the things Pearl wanted Jean to do. Yeah.
Okay.
So they had to keep the mine running. They didn't have enough in that 90 to 100 days in the summer. They had a good ore zone. We need to talk about that another time on how they happened upon this ore zone. But it lasted for about 7 years when they converted over to annual mining. But when they did, they had a lot of problems because they had to start insulating and improving. And, oh, my gosh, there was a monster problem. Bill left. He said, the heck with you guys. I'm not going to do this. I don't want to do this. I'm too old to do this. So he left and would go down to Seattle and leave Pearl to run the mine.
Oh, okay. And what happened then?
Yeah, well, where we started out was with the roads. Let me just make a few more comments on the roads.
Okay.
The Alaska Road Commission, in doing their improvement, really did stimulate the activity with the Alaska Railroad. It made a big difference. And they started to be able to justify more activity, and it became, something that people converted their thinking over to using the railroad. Prior, it was an afterthought.
Okay. So
it made a significant difference. But here we got Pearl. She was determined. She got her way. She got a majority vote. Bill voting to the contrary. And so they bring in a diesel engine. They put a big tank in. They have multiple trips with a tanker that comes up and fills the tank. And she's got a small mining crew. And so she stays there through the winter. And she's doing not only the cooking, but she's doing the milling. This is a lady with a lot of understanding on how to do things. Not a big person, but she had a lot of, a lot of energy, a lot of activity.
And willing to take a risk.
I'm sure she wouldn't call it a risk. They had a nice ore zone that they were stoping.
Right.
So they had the ore available. It was just a case, could they keep the mill running?
Well, that's the risk part.
Right. And on a cold spell, they'd have to shut it down. You couldn't keep the water running.
So let me just understand here. We've brought up a lot of fuel. The roads, presumably in the summer, early fall, were good. But those of us who have gone up to Hatcher Pass, even in the modern day, know that when snows come, the roads change a bit.
And that was the case even more so back then. We're dealing with the early 30s.
Okay.
The improvement to the road, late 20s, early 30s, and then everybody responding with diesel engines and fuel tanks and so on. So through the 30s, you have a lot of stimulation and activity in year-round mining. Late in the 30s, the Independence, for example, comes in. But the thing that made the big difference in activity was the movement of the gold price. Now, you got the Depression going on in the United States. It had, what would I call it, an opposite effect in Alaska, at least to the point, because you had commodity prices falling.
Yes.
You had a gold price that was fixed at $20.67 per ounce. At one point in 1933, our federal government decided that maybe gold is to blame for the Depression. You know, there's something going on here that we need to control. So by executive order, they called in all the gold. Everybody in America who owned gold was required to bring their gold in to the government. Well, the nice folks, the law-abiding folks, they did. Everybody else buried it in their backyard, you know. And, of course, they knew what was coming. And sure enough, early in 1934, they raised the price from $20 to $35. Right. Well, this was an electric thing for gold mining everywhere, but especially in Alaska. So you had a lot of response on properties that had been fallow for a long time, suddenly broke into life, one of them being the Independence. That's a whole other story. I'm a rabbit trail to follow. But sure. Before that, they showed up and did their work. I think the earliest they showed up was 37 when they got started. Okay. Doing the 900 level. So before that, from the early 1930s to 37, nobody was up in that valley of the Fishhook Creek except the Gold Cord Mine, which had Pearl doing the cooking and running the mill, and she had four or five miners, and it might have had one other mill assistant, I'm unsure, but it's a small camp, and talk about the end of the world wilderness, because the roads closed, no road maintenance.
Okay, were they able to use sledges or something else to, did they come down at all? Did anyone come up or down?
I hope we have time to talk about that one, because the miners were a very interesting group. They enjoyed the work they did, but pretty soon they'd start talking about going to Seattle. That was their catchphrase. Mm-hmm. And it would build, and it would build, and it would build. And finally, middle of the winter, February 1, whatever, Mrs. Horning, we just got to go to Seattle. You know, can you pay us? And we'll come back, but we just got to take a break. Well, she paid them off, and they would all go down the hill in snowshoes, the whole group of them, and some would make it to the Fishhook Inn and spend all their money, and some would make it to Palmer, and occasionally one might make it to Anchorage. But when their money was all gone, why, they'd wander back.
Snowshoe back up.
Yeah.
How long did it take to get to Anchorage?
You know, Anchorage, well, I can't remember when the road was put in from Palmer to Anchorage, but it was, of course, railroad was running, but it was the mid-30s that that was done in relation to the colony project.
So. Right. So let's back up just a bit, snowshoeing. Hardy people, if you're going to snowshoe down from the mine, that's one thing, to, say, Fishhook, and then from there to Palmer, or you probably would travel the road from Fishhook to Palmer. What was that like at that time?
It was questionable as to whether it was even open. There would be a minimum amount of maintenance on it to keep it open, but these miners may have to snowshoe all the way to Palmer, probably. Right. And like you say, it's all downhill, and they got a pocket full of money. And
there's incentive going down to make this happen. Yeah,
both life, good people.
Yeah, life is good.
So you've mentioned, and I don't think this is too far off the track that we're on, when you say there was some minimal road maintenance. Now, we're familiar with large trucks and plows that did things. How were roads maintained back in the day?
The usual grading in the summer was done with a grader that required a truck or a tractor to pull it.
Okay.
There was a big change in machinery of all kinds during this period of time. It just kept accelerating from the 20s into the 30s, inventing new ways to do things. Caterpillar Company was in the forefront. They finally put together a pretty good road grader that had a motor on it. And, it was an art form that was being developed. A lot of this equipment would work wonderfully well in the summer months, but it wasn't made to combat snowdrifts. So.
Snowdrifts, and I'm guessing the temperatures, because not all engines work well when it's below zero.
And the old ones especially had difficulty, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so there we are. The crew wanders off, and then some of them come back, and they continue on.
Well, yeah, the comeback was a struggle. Now it's uphill and with a hangover and probably without having eaten for a few days because their money's all gone. And, it's a real problem. Alan Horning, the son of Pearl,
right,
would come up when he could and try to help her. And he remembers, I talked to Alan at great length about a lot of these things when he was quite elderly. Mm-hmm. But he had wonderful stories about all of this. But he said in the early afternoon, they'd start looking down the valley with binoculars and seeing if there was any black specks moving down there. And when they saw them, they would watch to make sure they were going to make it. If not, they go down and help them.
Yeah.
But eventually they'd all get back, and then everything was fine again. They would go back to work and be happy until they started rumbling about Seattle.
So how many years did this go on with Pearl doing this and Bill saying, I'm off?
I'm not sure. I've asked that question of Alan and others, and nobody remembers correctly. It was probably 3 or 4 at least,
okay,
early 30s. And then when the independents came in, they were so fortunate because their initial discovery work was the very top of an enormous ore zone that made the mine. They didn't have much money to do anything. It was a real gamble.
The independents,
yeah. They hired, the best thing they did was they hired a really good practical miner who had grown up in the area up there and had done a lot of work in the bullion mine. So he knew the geology. He knew what to expect. And he was the one who encouraged them to throw the dice and put in this 900 level and connect it to a 700 level up above. And in the process of doing that, a spectacular ore was discovered.
Okay. How did that compare to the Goldcorp, for example?
It's a much bigger vein. The Goldcorp vein is a very difficult vein to mine because it pinches and swells appreciably.
Okay.
Yesterday we got the Hornings all the way from Iowa to the Goldcorp mine in a very circuitous path.
Right.
What we didn't get to talk about was that the initial work that they did at the Goldcorp, the ore was quite rich, and it was mined from the surface. It was a very unusual thing. And they were able to transport it by aerial tramway down to the mill owned by Billy Martin. And so they made some pretty good money. But what they also did was create a lot of interest, because some of this ore was probably 4 ounce. And a guy came by the name of Smith, who I know very little about, but he was a developer slash promoter from the Los Angeles area. But by gosh, he found them and he made them an offer to buy the gold cord as it existed then, basically as a surface mine. And I don't know the money amount, but the Bill Horning and Pearl and Charlie Barthoff said, hell yes, you know, you can have it. Because Charlie had already discovered a better mine. And so he didn't tell anybody about that except Bill and Pearl, of course. It later became known as the War Baby Mine. He found it during World War I. So they had an alternate. So they left. They sold the gold cord, went to the War Baby Mine, developed it, and there was quite a pattern of different mines they followed. But finally, they came back to the gold cord and bought it back.
Whoa, okay.
Because Smith hadn't done anything.
Oh.
Smith, well, I shouldn't say that. Smith had put in a good road so he could get investors up to see his project. He had put a mill in. He had done some underground work, but he was very discouraged when he followed there was a fault that had cut the vein off. He followed the fault in, and as he did so, in the fault gouge was very rich ore, pieces of it. So you would call it a drag ore. You know, the fault went one way or another, but they weren't smart enough to figure out where it was. But as they drove this tunnel in on that fault, pretty soon they had ore in the face. It was up above them. So they had a big area to do development work in, but as they got started on it, the vein pinched out. It went down to just a few inches. They were very discouraged, and so the end of it all was they quit work. Charlie Barthoff, he visits them quite often, curious on what they're doing, and he sees nothing happening, goes in and looks at it, and Charlie knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so Charlie offers to buy the mine back from them, and they're glad to sell it. So it was in the late 20s or early 30s when they moved back to the gold cord, and in a short order, Charlie and a crew continued a raise where the vein had pinched out, and the vein miraculously opened up into a huge ore zone. And it took them about 7 years to mine the ore in that stope. And it was all good stuff. In fact, they mined that out, and then they found out that there was another vein a little bit deeper underneath them, and they had to go back and mine it again. So
when you say good stuff and you use a reference such as 4 ounce, tell the listeners what that means.
4 ounces to the ton. Today that would mean I'm just looking at the gold price this morning, $1,150 roughly.
Mm-hmm.
So 4 times $1,150 for a ton of rock. Now, a ton of rock isn't a very big piece of rock. A cubic yard of rock in place is roughly 2 tons.
Okay.
So, you know, this is not... Yeah, so you've got, roughly $5,000, $4,500 worth of value in that, and double that for a cubic yard. This is good stuff.
It sounds like that. Well, Mike Molesky here with Dan Renshaw. We've been continuing on with another in the series of discussions about the mining in the Hatcher Pass area, the Independence Mine, the Gold Cord Mine, and others to come. So I think we're going to stop at this point because we've come to an interesting place in the road, and then we'll be back with the next in the series. Thank you, Dan.
Oh, thank you, Mike.